I'm not going to use the PowerPoint, so okay. I don't think I will.
All right. Is that in your way? Is it all right there?
Yeah, I think it's all right.
Okay.
Yeah. When do we get started? Do give it a few more minutes? Okay. Hey, how are you? Chris has told you about some of the programs. I think he's got a great chance. Okay, we're going to get started. People may be coming in, and lesson for Charles wanted me to make it very clear that what you're going to hear this morning is not necessarily the same that you will hear this afternoon. So if you're interested in hearing a particular teacher again, you won't be getting the same information. And so just keep that in mind as you think about the topic for this morning. My topic is really on the notion of reverence. And it's coming largely from a book by Paul Woodruff, professor, University of Texas Philosophy Department, called Reverence. And what I'm doing is I'm taking this notion and rereading Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 through 10. What I'd like to do, at least the first few minutes, is to have you write down, you can break up in groups of five or four people, and write down what you understand the word reverence to mean. What's your understanding of the word reverence? When you think of the word reverence, what's your definition of that term? So this is probably not going to be user-friendly in terms of the tape that's going to be distributed or perhaps the lack of tapes, but I would like you to start for about the first 5 minutes in your own mind, if you want to talk about this in groups. When you think of the word reverence, what comes to mind? What's your definition of that term? So we'll take a few minutes to do that before we get started. Good.
I'm Brett Armstrong.
Nice to meet you. Fred Aquino. Okay. Let me just give you a little background. I grew up in Niagara Falls, New York, in an Italian Roman Catholic family. I teach currently theology and philosophy classes, so part of my teaching strategy is to be dialogical or Socratic, which means you were asked a question, and I'm curious to hear what you've come up with in terms of the definition of reverence. Being reverent or having reverence means what? Okay. What else? So reverence implies respect, regard, awe for the other, for others, perhaps God. What other definitions or observations do we have today?
It's a separation from the common.
Separation from the common. Okay. Okay, so there's a spiritual dimension to reverence. There's a relational aspect to reverence that we're, in order for a person to have awe or respect for the other, there must be the other, right? There must be some sort of relationality that connects the human person to the object of reverence or respect or regard. Okay, other definitions or observations? So you all agree that reverence implies respect, regard for the other. I did hear one person say, I've never used the word, because it is, in some sense, it is a dated word. If you look at the title of the class, Becoming Fully Human, A Posture of Reverence, it makes you wonder, first of all, what does it mean to be fully human? And then how do you connect being fully human with being reverent? Hebrews 5 is actually a nice place to start. Hebrews 5, 7 through 10 is the focus for today. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and having been made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, having been designated by God a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Okay, Hebrews 5, 7 through 10 will be the focus for today. In answering the question, what does it mean to be fully human, and what does it mean for people who are fully human to have a posture of reverence? When you look at Hebrews, it's one of the most challenging books of the New Testament because it brings together things that I think we normally separate, and that is the divine and the human. And if you look in chapter 1, for example, in Hebrews, the Son is referred to in Hebrews 1 as God. Okay? Verse 8, but of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Verse 10, in the beginning, the Lord, you founded the earth and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like clothing, like a cloak. You will roll them up, and like clothing they will be changed, but you are the same, and your years will never end. But to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make you my enemies? Until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. So in Hebrews 1, you clearly have a reference to the Son as God. And you're probably wondering, so what does that have to do with being fully human? God is not human. God certainly is antecedent to humanity, since God is the creator of humanity, so there is a sense in which God is distinct from what it means to be human, at least in chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, the writer makes it very clear that these Christians who were struggling in the first century, this community or communities, The Hebrew writer makes it very clear. Not only do we have a superior priest in the sense that the Son is God, and unlike the angels, this Son is the Almighty, is God, is the Creator, is the also the very stamp of God's being. Hebrew writer in chapter 2 makes it very clear. This same God, the Son, is the same God who takes on human experience, our circumstances, in a way that I think would make us a little nervous. Look at chapter 2, verse 10. It was fitting. Now that's a really an interesting word, fitting. That word fitting means appropriate. This was right. This was not out of character. It was fitting that God, for whom and through whom all things exist in the beginning, in bringing many children to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through their sufferings. For the one who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one Father. For this reason, Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brothers and sisters. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, here am I in the children whom God has given me. Now, if you read verses 14 through 18, the Hebrew writer makes it very clear. The same Son that the Hebrew writer calls God in chapter 1 is the same Son that took on flesh and blood, took on our experiences. And because of that, this Son incarnate, this physical human being that we call Jesus, is the Son of God in flesh, took on flesh, experienced life as we experience it. And then the Hebrew writer says in chapter 4, that's why we have a sympathetic priest. In the midst of adversity, in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of the temptation to not assemble, not only on a Sunday, but not to assemble with the people of God because of circumstances that perhaps are beyond our imagination, at least today, the Hebrew writer says in chapter 4, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. Our confession is not necessarily a dogmatic doctrinal statement. Our confession is that we hold on to our allegiance to the Son of God, who is the pioneer of our salvation. Hebrew writer says, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without sin. Yet, he says, listen to this, let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness. Boldness why? I think about it, in the first century, you have people probably that are going to this church who, at some point in their lives, they've probably heard the Stoic, the Epicurean, the Platonic, the Aristotelian visions or understandings of the gods. And clearly, these philosophers were theologians in the sense that they believed in the unmoved mover and they believed in the various dimensions of the spiritual. But fundamental to those worldviews is these gods generally don't care about you. They're self-sufficient. Hebrew writer says to these struggling Christians, guess what? Not only do we have a God who creates reality in the sense that he brings things into existence, not only do we have a representative who is the stamp of God's very being, but we have a God who cares, who sympathizes. Now, it's interesting. We could get into a speculation, and Randy Harris is right. Some people would say God had it all figured out. He knew everything in advance, right? Hebrew writer seems to think there's a little messiness in terms of what God does here, right? You sympathize with people when you actually have experiences similar to people, right? It's like an elder saying to a member in the congregation, member loses a child, and you've never lost a child, and you say, I can sympathize with you. How meaningful is that? Well, as a parent, I've had to deal with things. I have a son who's had a problem with his eye ever since he was born, and for you to come to me and say, I can sympathize with you, well, if you really want to know what I think, I'd probably offend you with my language, because you don't understand. You might theoretically imagine that you understand, but the text here seems to be saying that God is not theoretically imagining what it means to be human. God became human. Really took on our experiences. Now, you can psychologize this and say, did God have impure thoughts and all that, but the writer's not saying that. The writer's just saying, our God can sympathize with us as a high priest, our God being the Son of God. Now read on. Hebrews chapter 5. Every high priest chosen from among the mortals is put in charge of things pertaining to God on their behalf to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He's able to deal gently with the ignorant and wayward since he himself is subject to weakness. And because of this, he must offer sacrifice for his own sins as well as for those of the people. And one does not presume to take this honor, but takes it only when called by God, just as Aaron was. Okay. The connection there, I think the Hebrew writer is making, is that our link with God, our connection with God, is not a theoretical connection. Unfortunately, in our context today, when people deal with the word reverence, they think reverence means adherence to ideas and theories and assumptions, or what I would call a pie-in-the-sky theology that really does not take seriously human circumstances, human tragedies, and that what happens is we end up sacrificing authenticity for a sort of pie-in-the-sky theology that is exempt from human messiness. We assume that to take our experience seriously would get in the way of placating God's wrath, because we know God's upset with us and therefore has to be appeased. And so we appease God by talking about things sometimes that have no grounding in human experience. This perspective, in my mind, reduces salvation to nothing more than a heavenly pardon. Sort of get out of jail free card. It diminishes the present by only focusing on what is exclusively relevant to the future. That is to say, the sort of when we all get to heaven. The problem with that is the Hebrew writer won't let us get away with that, because the Hebrew writer says theology matters not only in the future, it matters now. It helps us to think through what it means to be truly human. Being truly human for the Hebrew writer is not being less than or more than human. It is being human. Because our God, this is the weird stuff, our God gave us a wonderful and profound model or example of what it means to be human by, listen to the text, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries. Now, we struggle with that because we say, well, God's not really experiencing that. God's playing like he's experiencing that. It's all just an appearance. And so, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is not really what was on the mind of the Son of God. That's just according to his flesh. So what we've done is we've taken the divinity out of the equation of the human and the divine. But the Hebrew writer refuses to do that. Refuses to separate God into these categories. With loud cries and tears, the one who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. I kind of wonder how reverence and sort of crying out and saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? How those two realities can be combined in one sentence and then understood to be an act of absolute reverence, piety, respect, regard for God. It seems to me the Hebrew writer does not want our humanity to be understood in simple categories. We're either human, which means we pull up our bootstraps and say, we're going to do this thing on our own, or we appeal to God who gets us out of every trouble without any sense of human involvement or strategies. You know, the God thing. Problem with that is, in the Hebrew text here, is our God doesn't do that. He doesn't. He really does experience circumstances that are problematic. I don't know how to explain how God experiences death. Christians for 2,000 years have been trying to explain that. Or how a God incarnate needs and desires, because the gods of the Greco-Roman world have no needs. They're self-sufficient. But our God cares, sympathizes with us, and shows us that being fully human is not exclusively a divine or human enterprise. It is both. So the line that says that to be human is to err is false. Being fully human is being like God, and being like God is being divine and human. The Hebrew writer says, therefore, remember in his days of the flesh, remember the same Son that we said is God in chapter 1 is the same Son that cries out and is heard. Although he was a son, okay, if you're wondering where to get that from, where did I get that? Well, chapter 1, but also chapter 5, verse 8. Although he was a son, he learned obedience. Ooh, scary stuff. God's not in the business of learning, right? Now, I'm not going to pull the card on you and say that's just what the text says. That's my interpretation. Luke also says that, right? He grew in stature and wisdom. And we can say, well, he grew as a human being, but that's not what the text says here. It doesn't say human or divine. Because it says son, although he was a son. Gods don't learn. Gods don't experience human circumstances. Our God does. The text for today, it seems to me, assumes that Jesus is the prime example of what it means to be fully human. He is, yes, the reflection of God's very being and the impression of his essence, if you want to use that word. But the surprising thing about our text today is that our fleshly condition is both affirmed and embodied. In other words, being human is not a bad thing. Yes, can we make bad decisions? Yes, can we do things that are horrific? Yes, the human history is replete with examples of human tragedies. I would say that is not an example of what it means to be human. His refusal to take up the charge to be fully human by being a person of reverence, which means you have respect for, regard for, not only the good things, but you understand in the midst of tragedy, the simple thing is to say, being reverent is giving someone a quick, trite answer in the midst of circumstances of suffering that are really hard to calculate. I have students come to my office now and tell me they don't know if they believe in God. And the easy thing for me to do is to try to do a little logical demonstration and get them to think, you know, ooh, impressive language, impressive arguments. But the human thing to do is to remember that every day when I get up, I have to remind myself, honestly, there are days and moments when I think, I don't understand all this stuff. I don't understand people praying in the midst of hurricanes and saying that God is awesome and amazing as people are losing their properties and their histories. And that somehow that's being reverent. Being reverent, it seems to me, with Jesus, it is a time in which we cry out with loud tears and we're heard because of our posture, which is a posture that takes seriously the contingency of human experience, that we're not done deals. And in the text we see, I think, and I'm using this word, so if you're a purist, I'm not saying it's in the text. In Jesus, it seems to me, we see a collaboration of the human and divine. A journey filled with struggles, real decisions, not false decisions, but real decisions. And that life for Jesus is a life of real confrontation. Temptation is not a bogus enterprise for God. It is a real enterprise, plagued with the appeal for power. And that's the temptation story in the gospel, is the appeal there is an appeal for power. And our God says the right way to use power is to use power in service of the other out of respect for, regard for, reverence for life. Life for Jesus in the Hebrew story is not about exploiting the prerogative that belongs to God, because clearly God's the creator. God can do whatever, right? To some extent. But our God is interested in doing what is fitting, and what is fitting is being human. Wisdom, knowledge, stature, and all of these things in Hebrews requires a process of becoming. And I don't claim to understand what it means for the son to learn through obedience and through what he suffers, but I'm uncomfortable with our tendency to sort of create dichotomies and say, well, what that means is when he was a human person, he learned, and with his divinity was kind of over there on the side, not really learning. It's sort of like a ghost in the machine, right? God's a ghost in the machine. I guess what I kind of think is that God theoretically perhaps knew what it meant to be human by never being a human, but actually experienced humanity by becoming human. And so instead of our sort of limited, minimal definition of being human, which is kind of survival mechanism, right? Take care of ourselves, and being human is being sort of, you know, depraved and bad. Actually, the humanity we're called to think about and embody as a posture of reverence is the humanity of God. Now that, to me, has profound implications for ministry. Temptation one is when we get into a rut, right, and we're not quite sure if we can get God out of jail or get him off the hook. So what we do is we posit really easy answers. Look, God's left the world to itself. We're going to fend for ourselves, and that's all we have. Or somehow God's behind all of these really disastrous circumstances, and sorry, your call is to just buckle up, pledge allegiance to a God who is arbitrary and somehow finds delight in being praised by some absurdities. Now, I'm being honest. I have to deal with this every day in terms of my own family. My son, last week, my 6-year-old asked me in the car on the way to school, does God make mistakes? His question this 2 days ago was, have you ever met Santa Claus? I said, well, David, I hear that people have met Santa Claus. And then the God making mistakes is he's in Bible class. My guess is he's kind of paying attention to the stories, especially some of the Old Testament stories where God seems awfully interesting in the sense that some of the times you look at what God's asking people to do and you wonder, what's up with that? And I didn't answer my son. I didn't know what to say to a 6-year-old. Does God make mistakes? But obviously for him to ask that question means it's not. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out if you read Scripture long enough and you look at God and how God takes on the human circumstances of this example in Hebrews chapter 5, you quickly realize God's not as troubled by human, messy situations as much as we are. So we want to clean them up, create dichotomies and say, well, God's in control, And to be honest with you, when I hear that, I just think, what does that mean to a person who's just lost his or her house? Control for whom? For the person who's got it all neat and tidy and happy? The Hebrew writer invites us, I think, in our ministry to be incarnational in this sense, that we are not exempting God from the messy stuff. We're not getting God off the hook. God understands the human situation because God has become one of us. And that's why we can say to our brother Jesus, to our pioneer, out of reverence, we desire to be fully human. We desire to be like God. This is a very hard issue because I didn't grow up in Churches of Christ, so I've been in for about the last 21 years, and here's how I understand it. When I got in, we were kind of pulling up our bootstraps and saying, you know, you're not sure if you're in or out, and you better be praying, you better be studying, you better be reasoning your way out of it. Well, now we've gotten more enlightened, and we think God's kind of in charge, and forget human responsibility, forget worrying about your salvation, God's got it all worked out. And I guess what I see in those two tendencies is the refusal to live with the tension in Hebrews 5. That when Jesus is tempted, he doesn't just sort of stop and say, well, wait a minute, let me put my God thing in the machine and get out of the circumstance, just kind of trump the discussion. Or he doesn't say, well, you know, let me just pull up my bootstraps. There's a sense in which our God, through Jesus, gives us a wonderful example of what it means to be fully human. Paul the Apostle says that in Ephesians, that we're called to be a new humanity. And I think the Hebrew writer makes it very clear whatever order of Melchizedek is about. I'll let you folks clarify that and explain that sometime. Maybe today at lunch you can sit me down and tell me what that means. But what it seems to me that it suggests is that humans are called to be like God, but that is not a simple or easy or short process. And maybe when we start rethinking these categories, we might view the Christian life as an opportunity to enter into a process that will probably take us a lifetime. And we will make mistakes, and we will say things that are trite, and we will overestimate or underestimate things. But what I like about the Hebrew text is it refuses to let us move outside of that messiness. It calls us to take seriously reverence. And when I use this book in class, I use this book in class because this author is not a Christian. And the students, when they read the book, they say, you know, he's certainly critiquing religion. Well, what he's critiquing is the religious person who equates reverence with quick, simple answers and the inability to take life seriously in terms of mystery, in terms of realizing how finite we are and yet how wonderful we are as parts of a larger reality and a larger context. And what I see in the Hebrew text, the reason I put these two together, is I see Jesus as a wonderful example of reverence in the midst of circumstances that had to be tragic. You have a God who seems very open to caring. And I can imagine if I'm a person who's not on the verge of not really continuing in the faith, and I hear this, I'm thinking, man, that's amazing. It's amazing that we have a God who is more comfortable with our humanity than we are. Mark, I don't mean more comfortable like a sort of easy ride, but what I mean is our God seems to be more committed to the inherent goodness of being a physical creature, of being a person with intentions and with reasoning processes and emotions than a God who just says, look, either buckle up or get out. And what I like about the Christian message in Hebrews is this God is a God who shapes human beings, but shapes human beings through a profound respect for the ordinary. There's that connection. And you folks are going to help me for the rest of my life in my struggle to understand why Christians sometimes want to negate their humanity and downplay it. What is it that provokes us to have a lack of reverence and respect for our humanity while we respect and have a regard for our Creator? Our Creator implies a creation, and we're not a plaything. There's a profound respect for being fully human. Okay, I've got 11:25. I think we have some time. I'm going to open it up for questions if you have any. That's all I had to say. Main point is, if you forget everything, sorry, no PowerPoint, no outline. My main point is that being a Christian equals being fully human. And being fully human means having the posture of reverence, which means that you take seriously the contingency of life and try not to downplay a person's experiences, good or bad, by pulling the ultimate divine trump card. Our God doesn't seem to do that in this text. Our God seems to submit Himself to our circumstances for us. And that's a hard message to, I think, process in church, but I see a lot of people hurt and wounded by a religion that does not allow them to be honest in the midst of their struggles. And, you know, we hear, as professors, we hear that, well, just teach them how to process, you know, the answers and give them the steps of how to do church work. I don't think that's a solution. At least, as far as I can tell, most of the people that attend church, people in the pews, you get out with them, eat lunch with them, go in their home, you realize they've got questions. They want to know about life. I had a student last night ask me, do you pray? What is prayer? Because when people are praying in the midst of circumstances that are really tragic and they don't see anything, the question is, then theoretically maybe prayer has a point, but really what point does it have? What is the point? And what is Jesus doing when he's praying here? He's praying, according to the text, I think, if you go back to the garden, I think he's praying for some empowerment, understanding, because you've got a God who's about to experience death. And again, I don't know what that means. Here's the last thing and then questions. The thing, maybe I'm having a midlife crisis. I'm 42. The thing I start thinking about is, you know, the ultimate challenge for Christianity is that one day we're going to die, right? And we can't be in control of that and be in charge of that. And we have to yield our lives over to a being that we kind of speculate about, right? Have a quasi-experience about. And the text says, I think Jesus, out of his reverent submission, this person in the midst of circumstances that are really complex, is capable on some level of yielding to a power beyond his own. Well, that's challenging. How do you get people to understand that you can entrust yourself to a being that isn't always obvious and or naked or apparent to our simple attempts to see? How do you do that? How do you get people in inner city ministry when every day we say, well, if you would just try, and you realize the problem of moral luck, that people sometimes have no control of where they were born and how they were, you know, the place they were located in. How do you communicate to them in some sense that ministry is not making facile, simple, speculative remarks about economy, but actually taking seriously the nature of the circumstances and saying that our God somehow understands what it means to be downtrodden?
understands what it means to be powerful. But the key is this reverence that does not try or to assume that you and I are the same and have the same experiences, and by golly, we have the same God, so what's the problem? That's hard, I think, as a professor. That's hard to look at a student and not downplay the student because the student doesn't always articulate this or that. You understand when you get to see students and you talk to them in your office, you realize very quickly, sometimes it's not about the existence of God, it's about the fact that these are people with histories and questions and experiences that cannot be summed up in a lecture. That's hard because as professors we're trained to pay attention to the content of their statements. Which what that assumes is that the content of their statement is separated from their personhood. And that's hard. It's hard. All right, questions?
Did you say that part of being a human is also being spiritual or having a spirit? And kind of the context of God's Holy Spirit being within us.
I don't know how Christians can be both human and divine without having divinity in them. And I think the Holy Spirit is given to us as a gift, but I don't think spiritual means being something less than physical. Christianity has never postulated the idea of a soul without a body. Now, we could get into the neuroscience stuff and the philosophy of mind stuff about the nature, the relationship between the mind and the body. We won't do that today unless you want to later. But it seems to be the Christian claim is that the divine and the human are separate, certainly different, but they're integrated into a person. And so I can't imagine being spiritual as a Christian without some connection to your physical identity.
I had kids in a high school class say, well, how do I know I have a spirit? I've never seen one.
Right.
Just like I've never seen the spirit of God as God, but I've also never seen my own spirit.
Sure.
At high school.
They're thinking rightly, I think. But we've kind of, what I would say, we haven't used this language, but we've assumed what I would call logical positivism, that if it can be confirmed, verified, or falsified, it's true. The problem with that is it doesn't follow in all the sciences. There are things that scientists would tell you that are speculative in nature. It doesn't mean that they're meaningless because they can't be confirmed. It just means that we have these parameters, right? And we say, can't feel, can't touch God, therefore he doesn't exist. Well, that's an assumption. Okay? You can't confirm and verify morality either. You know that, right? And yet people every day assume that going out and torturing someone is not a good thing. You can't verify that. And I think what we have to get probably better at here is being a little more holistic about what it means to be human. And not pull, the spirituality card and say, I'm spiritual, you can't access that, therefore whatever I say is okay because God and I had a conversation about it and it's incoherent. I think what we have to do is we have to do a better job of seeing the connection between what I would call redemption and creation. If you look at Christianity, redemption or salvation is the reaffirmation of the created order. Okay, Jesus is the second Adam. He's the new humanity. He had a body. And so God empowering us is not some sort of ghost. It is the bringing together. And I don't claim to know all of what that means, but I think we're going to have to do a better job of appreciating that connection rather than always separating them. That's the way I would put it. Hand over here. Somebody had a... Yes? Do you have a particular reference?
I was just thinking about how that was performed. What was the situation with the cultural setting? It seems something totally out of any culture's perception.
I'm not a specialist. Mark Hamilton, who teaches Hebrew Bible for us, is... We did a course together on what is befitting of God.
we pose this question, what is befitting? And it's interesting when you go back into some of the ancient Near Eastern literature to see that there are physical representations of the divine. So I don't think that that's new. I think what's fairly unique in Christianity is that we're saying our God not only cares, but takes on human expressions, human experiences. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily absolutely unique, but it seems to be pretty pivotal to Christianity. That this, and I think if you look at the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, there seems to be a very open awareness that the physical world, again, is not devoid of the divine in the sense that the physical is good. It's connected to its ultimate reality, God. And so it seems to me Christianity is not just making stuff up. It's taking this to another level, which is to say our God created the world and then became a part of the creation, and by showing us what that means, because it seems that humans have failed to get that. They have failed to connect their experience with a creator and have created these separate categories. And so I see Christianity, not perfectly, because there are certainly historical problems there, but Christianity rethinking, for example, in the Gospels, possessions, which you have in the Old Testament, rethinking relationships. So it's not like this is all just in a vacuum, but it seems to me the Christian message is to say, Torah is not bad. I mean, when Jesus talks about the Sermon on the Mount, it seems to me he's saying, this is good stuff in the Torah. Now let's internalize it and rethink it in terms of what it really calls us to become. That's... Somebody had their hand up. Yes?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's so many questions that I'm not young enough to really answer. So, but what's the difference between, and I'm posing just a rhetorical question, the difference between being a spiritual person and people talk about, well, he's really spiritual. There's a difference between being a spiritual person and being a spiritual being. And this was drawn to me from my favorite bumper sticker. You've probably seen it. Because people talk about having spiritual experiences. The bumper sticker said, I am not a human being having a spiritual experience. I am a spiritual being having a human experience. And that says, for me, that says a lot.
Yeah. You know, Origen of Alexandria got in trouble for saying that there's a pre-incarnate soul that takes on a body. That was rejected by the church historically. People have rethought that. But I think however we conceptualize what it means to be spiritual, I think the Christian claim is that the physical cannot be removed from that process. And when I think of spiritual, I'm thinking of a person who realizes I'm not a full-blown materialist. What I see is not necessarily all that is in the world. In other words, on the, again, problem of consciousness, you have people who study the brain and say, look, we can locate all the connections in the brain, and consciousness is it's epiphenomena. In other words, it's really nonsensical. It seems to me what we're saying is there's more to the world than a brute materialism. There's more to the world than just the sort of bankrupt materialism that leads to, I think, nihilism. That being spiritual, you realize there's some mediating realities. Some realities are mediated through the physical, and that the universe has a contingency to it in the sense that there may be something more to life than the obvious or what the naked realities. And it seems to me that's a profound dilemma for us today, because the materialist is saying, look, we've shown you that we take this more seriously than you do. And I think the Christian response isn't to say, well, that's great, you're a materialist, we're not. I think the Christian response is to say, there's more to human experience than this sort of brute, basic, empirical minimalism. And that's what I mean by spiritual. Is there something profoundly enmeshed in what we would understand to be the world of physical causes, the world of our embodiedness? But again, that's one perspective.
I don't know. I think about this a little bit more, but it seems to me that this helps me in considering using language of Psalms. It's always found it helpful because it's language of lament. It gives me license to cry out. But what you're talking about in Hebrews kind of brings it more, I don't know if the word is more significance or, I mean, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's maybe perhaps it's the Christian view versus the Jewish view.
I don't know if I'd say it's the verse. I would say I'm glad the lament psalms are in the Psalms. I think you can be profoundly reverent by uttering, my God, why have you forsaken me? Or like Psalm 73, it's one of my favorite psalms. It might say too much about me, but I'm glad to know that our God is not afraid of, and I think that can be worship, I guess the way I would put it. Worship isn't just a victory dance. It's not just the, we've gotten to the top. And if anything, the Gospels tell us that the victory dance is the very thing that God's critiquing, the sort of, you know, transfigured state that Jesus calls him on the carpet and says, oh, get ready for something that's going to be profoundly disturbing, death, betrayal, rejection. And it seems to me we've got to do a better job of seeing worship as more than just articulating the touchdown. You know, we made it. When people in our churches are saying, I'm not there. I want to believe. I want to believe what you're saying. Well, then what we say is, well, you just aren't reverent enough.
You know, in verse 8, it's really amazing stuff going on there when he says he was the son and he learned obedience that you're talking about from what he suffered, and once made perfect, he became the source of, you know, that implies that he wasn't perfect. And when he at the point that he became perfect, is that upon his death? Or I guess it's really irrelevant because it still implies that there was a time that he wasn't perfect. And that's hard for us to think that God's son, you know, there was a time when he didn't know everything and he wasn't perfect. And that helps us with that reverence, that bonding of the humanity.
Randy would agree that you can smell heresy coming out, because there were early Christians who took this to mean that the Son of God was not God, but was eventually adopted by God and became the Son of God. And they would use a text like this to say that you have an example of the Son being inferior to the Father, therefore the idea of becoming perfect means you're not necessarily perfect, therefore the Son is not equal to the Father. That's one way to read it. It's a speculative reading. Another way to read it is that this is the first time in the life of God in which this has happened, and so in some sense it's not a done deal. That's another way to read it. There are probably three or four. You could be a modalist. You could say, well, God wears a mask, and one time he looks like this, the next time he looks like that, and there's nothing real here. This is just for us. It's just an economy. It's just for our human understanding. And what I would say on that is, let's be really clear that since the text isn't as clear as we'd like it to be, we probably should allow for some latitude. This is complex. We're trying to figure out, this is Christology, by the way. We're trying to figure out the nature of the person and the work of Christ, whatever that means. But one thing it does seem to suggest is that humans can find some connection with their God through this. But metaphysics is good. I teach it. I think it's great. We should keep it in the church. I'm just not ready to trash someone over a metaphysic, because it's at this point it is speculation. Yes?
I'm hearing an encouraging word of prophet here, where there's this picture of, listening to you this morning, where there's this picture of God who moved from creator to creation to experience in the flesh a process that brought him to perfection. As we in the flesh connected with him experience a process that brings us into perfection.
Well, I mean, think about the word Christian, right? We could argue it's only, what, three times in the New Testament. I'm not going to do that. We're not going to do the word game. Bible names, Bible. Okay, whatever. But it seems to me fundamental Christianity is to become like God, right? And becoming like God means becoming like the icon of God, Jesus, right, the Son of God, the image of God, image and likeness of God. So if that's the goal, right, why do we keep couching this discussion in terms of being in or out? Right? I mean, I remember the old debates with the Baptists, right? We got really nervous, you know, you can make mistakes. And Hebrews 6 doesn't make it easy, because it does talk about people kind of leaving the faith. But I think what we got to talk about more in terms of reverence and being fully human is, as a parent, when I think about my son David and my daughter Elizabeth, I have some magical moments, but I wouldn't want to reduce their identity to those. I'd want to say being a parent means we're in it for the long haul. There are going to be times where they frustrate me, I frustrate them. Marriage? Oh. I'm glad my wife will keep me, my eccentric tendencies. But we understand that our marriage is based on something more than disappointment and excitement. There's this sort of covenant, union, bond. And it seems to me what the Hebrew writer is saying is, hang on, hang on. This is not the end. There is the promised land, right? Chapter 4. But don't be deceived into thinking that somehow God created a promised land without a journey. And don't be dismissive of the fact. And sometimes the Old Testament examples, I feel bad for the Old Testament writers, because sometimes, like when Paul's reading Abraham, model citizen. I'm reading the Old Testament, I'm thinking, wait a minute, this guy lied. But I think what the writers sometimes in the New Testament are really looking at is we look the stages and the steps. They're kind of making these really gigantic statements, and so we take out the process and say, we want the end product, but I don't know how you become a Christian without practicing Christianity.
Verse 8,
we need to stop.
It sort of implies that there's a transformation. You know, having learned obedience, having been made perfect, but it is an ongoing transformation of spiritual maturity.
Yeah, because once you get out of the waters, I remember when I was baptized, I came into the Church of Christ as a pretty radical pagan. And I was thinking, it's great, you know, I'm clean, until I realized, you know, a little bit later that I still had desires and I still had weaknesses and problems. But then I thought, you know, okay, where's the water? I need it again. And the point I missed was I was being initiated into a process rather than a purifying or a cleansing, although that's probably part of it. Now, this afternoon, my point in the talk will be from Philippians 1, 8 through 10, I'm going to ask the question, what does practical wisdom entail? And I think for Paul it means understanding what matters and kind of go through that and maybe make some connections hopefully to you. I'm not very good at giving you a list of practical suggestions. I won't apologize for that. I just don't want to assume that. I don't want you to assume I'm going to deliver the goods and you're like, duh, we've been here. We know that. But I'm more interested in helping you process some things in Philippians and let you make the applications in your church context, because I don't really know your church context. I can't understand. I can't presume to do that for you, because I live in Abilene with my own particular experiences and situations. So you can do that. I guess I entrust that to you. And I hopefully we can process some more things. Thanks for your time and your questions.
Charles said, we're going to be upstairs.
Good.
We need to talk to everybody.
How is it?